Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. Today, we're recording on Wednesday, July 5th. We've just had a great July 4th in the United States. I'm in Pennsylvania. This is Catherine Austin Fitz and John Titus for Money and Markets. We have a lot to talk about, John. What's our theme?
The theme is the revolution was in the minds of the people. That is a quote from John Adams.
So this is one of my favorite quotes about the revolutionary period. Yeah. And John Adams wrote this after the war and said, you know, that the revolution wasn't the war, that the war was the consequence of the revolution. The revolution was in the minds of the people. And right. What he meant was you had a shift, a profound shift in consciousness. And if you look at how the revolution was won, it wasn't a lot of people. But you had a profound shift of consciousness in a variety of people who could engineer the revolution. And it's real funny. One of Senator Nicely's favorite quotes about the revolution is he said, Washington said, all hope is lost. You know, we've lost. He's got this great quote of Washington says lost. And he said, and then some really ornery folks from East Tennessee showed up and they won a battle in East Tennessee in that area and boom. It was, I don't know the details of it, but it just goes to show you it's never over till it's over. So
yeah, that's John Adams. My own favorite quote is Samuel Adams, who said, it does not take a majority to prevail. All you need is an irate and tireless minority keen on setting brush fires in people's minds. Because that describes us.
That exactly. Okay. So let's dive in.
Let's set some brush fires. Okay, let's start with the Crisis Watch. It's still ongoing, if the propaganda is any indication. But before we get to the propaganda, let's look at an interesting graphic from the good people who does this? This is Visual Capitalist.
Visual Capitalist.
Visualizing the assets and liabilities of U.S. banks. And I just want to point out something here. So they've got, their color scheme isn't the best. They've got blue for assets, and gold for liabilities, which is, I wouldn't have chosen that. But anyway, liabilities, assets on the left, and that's what we want to focus on. And what I want to point out here is basically this, the assets are divided into thirds. You have regular kind of loans, traditional loans, okay? Commercial loans, consumer loans, commercial real estate loans, residential real estate. This would be called a loan portfolio, and we'll see that term in a minute. This means you just have these loans yourself. You haven't sold them into the market. You're just going to hold on to them until they come to the maturity. Then you have, basically, let's just call it cash. Okay, they say cash assets. That really means reserves. That does not mean Federal Reserve notes. That's most of that. And then trading assets would be things like stocks. And then down here, you have this is treasuries and agency securities, meaning mortgage-backed securities. And then you have these other securities, which means mortgage-backed securities and asset-backed securities that don't have the government backing, because if they did have the government backing, they would be in this pile.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So that's
right.
That's basically how that shakes out. Now let's go to our first story from Financial Times. U.S. steps up sales of loan portfolios to private lenders. So loan portfolios is the traditional loans you're holding to maturity. Okay. So, and they're pointing to this story, is pointing to this little bank, PacWest, which isn't, I don't think it's dead yet, but it's certainly in trouble. PacWest is in trouble. So the Financial Times tells us, and this is where the propaganda starts, regional and mid-sized U.S. banks have stepped up efforts to sell off their loan portfolios. Okay. Regional banks. We're back to that old saw. Uh-huh. Ares this week is the buyer. They agreed to buy $3.5 billion with a B. That's a pittance in the scheme of things. In loans from PacWest, the California bank that came under pressure when SVB collapsed, it paid $2 billion for assets that were worth $2.07. That doesn't sound like much of a haircut. PacWest had previously raised $2.36 billion. Okay. And they tell you here, the Financial Times, the vast majority of sellers and potential sellers were regional banks. So again, we're back to this point, which they make several times. But then we get on to this, and you look who makes an appearance right away. So it's a regional bank problem. And yet, this trend is particularly pronounced, including with banks like HSBC, U.S. arm, which is a huge bank, okay? Another bank that's selling its loan portfolios would be Goldman Sachs, okay? So right away, you see that in this story, you don't even have to go beyond the four corners of the story
right.
to see that the majority of people selling their loan portfolios aren't regional banks. In fact, they're SIFIs. They're global SIFIs.
Right.
Both of those banks, HSBC and Goldman Sachs, are on the FSB's, the Financial Stability Board's, list of global systemically important banks. It's not a regional banking problem.
Right. And I don't have access to the guts of Goldman or HSBC's loan portfolio. But where you have the biggest problem, Morgan Stanley just came out and said the commercial real estate market is in for a rougher time than during the bailout period. And the reason they are, if you look at U.S. commercial real estate, there's almost $6 trillion of outstanding commercial real estate mortgages. And about $1.4 trillion rolls over between now and 2027. About $250 billion is scheduled to roll over this year still.
So out of $6 trillion.
Out of $6 trillion. But yeah. Remember, you have in the big downtown areas where the pandemic hit, you've got yeah. occupancy rates. You know, I just talked to somebody about a huge mall near where I am. The occupancy rate is now less than 30%. So you,
Whoa.
Yeah, you have downtowns with occupancy rates of 50% or less. And remember, these loans have been made at lower interest rates. They have to right. roll over when interest rates are not only much higher, but now with low occupancy rates, the risk is much higher. So,
well, not only that, okay, people aren't paying on the loans. It doesn't even, at that point, it doesn't matter if you're holding them to maturity or not, if you're not getting an income stream.
You don't have an income stream to carry the debt at the current interest rates. It's just not
right,
it's not going
right.
to work. Now and part of it is if you look at what's happened to those buildings, you know, they've been between the pandemic and sort of the attack on the downtown areas, no policing, riots, all these kinds of things. You're getting a situation where you can't make things work economically. And if you look at those downtown areas, big commercial buildings, you know, everybody now working from home, who do you think has those in their portfolios? Now, I just read an article yesterday that implied that it was the small banks. I assure you, the small banks are not carrying the loans of big commercial buildings in downtown San Francisco. That's not where
right.
the right. So
right.
so
right.
so. We don't have a good breakdown of where the rollovers relate geographically, you know, but I dare say the vast majority of the problems are in the large banks here.
Yeah. We just saw that in a Financial Times article.
Right, right.
So they had to pick the worst of the small banks, PacWest, but then the next two go-tos for their regional bank thesis are global SIFI banks, HSBC
right.
and Goldman. Are you kidding me? Your own story refutes itself. It's unbelievable.
Well, if you okay. look, another point to make, if you look at the chart you showed of, you know, whether they have the loan on their balance sheet or they run it through Freddie and Fannie, most of the
right.
small banks do residential. So they've got single family, multifamily. And the big question on a lot of those banks, are they running it through Freddie and Fannie and FHA, and it's going into the loan portfolio as opposed to, you know, they're keeping it on balance sheet and it's in the loan portfolio. But,
it looks,
but
yeah.
But, you know, right now the residential market looks much healthier and stronger than the commercial. So I cannot
yeah.
believe you got a big problem in the small banks.
They're selling that. They're selling it. Like hotcakes.
Yeah, and
as it
drives the stocks down, the insiders and the small banks are buying. They're not stupid.
Right, right.
Right.
We saw that a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's go to propaganda in the final story. Propaganda story number two and the last story in Crisis Watch. This involves our good friend BlackRock and Larry Fink. BlackRock to the rescue. Here it comes to save the day. Okay, this story is ridiculous too. It doesn't answer any questions. But it pumps propaganda. So BlackRock's been hired to sell $115 billion worth of failed bank securities. So failed bank securities, that would be, that's not portfolio loans, right? That's loans over here, probably other secure, right? Okay, so BlackRock's been brought in to sell these things. Why isn't, okay, so the initial matter is, well, why aren't they brought in to sell the portfolio loans? Okay, the story never answers that, but let's just continue on with the story. According to the FDIC, BlackRock will conduct the sale of $27 billion of securities from Signature and $87 billion from Silicon Valley Bank. The holdings are mostly agency-backed securities. Okay, so this is backed by the government, right? Collateralized mortgage obligations and commercial MBS. So these, in other words, it's really...
So there's the commercial MBS.
Right.
That I was just talking about, right?
Yep, that's what they're selling, okay?
So, but here's the thing. They were chosen by these two banks have gone into receiver, and so it's the, you know, I don't know if it's the California state government or the feds. Government is steering this through BlackRock, and the question is why?
The question is why? That's a great question. Why? In other words, why? Okay, let's say you're selling that stuff. That's fine. I'm not sure why you're not selling the portfolio loans too, but whatever. Maybe somebody else is doing that. The article never says. But the question is why? Why are they doing this? Why isn't the FDIC doing this? Okay, look at the reason given by this article. This is just ridiculous. This move by BlackRock aims to not only benefit the government and the FDIC, but also the economy as a whole. By selling these securities in a gradually and orderly manner, the potential for any adverse impact on market functioning is minimized. Well,
that's complete BS. That is total.
Of course it is.
And the FDIC could dispose of these in a gradual process and use competitive bidding, competitive bidding. And the only reason why you wouldn't want to do it is when you want to put money in BlackRock's pocket, so it's payola, or you want to keep something secret.
Yep. The you only wanted- reason you bring BlackRock in is if you need to sell them quickly, because they have the bandwidth to do that. And the FDIC can slow walk it, just as slow as BlackRock can.
Right. Right. Well, here's the question. Is there something about the commercial portfolio, the commercial MBS, that they want to keep quiet or steer?
Great question. That's a great question, because a FOIA to BlackRock's not going to get you anything.
Okay, so I'll just be a bad guy here. Because let's go back to the pandemic. Remember, we had 37 cities where or 37 cities where there's Fed offices. 34 of those offices had nearby riots. What a coincidence.
Right.
And
right.
I said, okay, if I was going to build the smart grid out, I'd want to make sure it was, you know, first built into, you know, the pipeline was first built into the Fed offices. And so the question is, on any of that commercial MBS, because you're going to have a lot of defaults, is there steering going on? It's just a question, but.
Right.
Right.
Right. It's a good question.
BlackRock is your man for steering. I know. So just disclosure, at Hamilton, I hired BlackRock to help do the HUD loan sale programs. That's how they first got on the advisory side of, you know, I hate to say this, we helped train them for this business. And the guy, you know, the guy who ran it was brilliant, got so fed up with the corruption of BlackRock, he took off after the whole thing. But that's how I got to, you know, have fights with Larry Fink.
Wow, that's a big demerit there, Fitz. That's not good.
Well, the BlackRock wasn't BlackRock then. They were just, you know, young and starting out.
Yeah, yeah. Just starting out. They didn't even have $1 trillion back then.
Well, but the guy I hired it to get Wes Edens, and they did a great job. He was great. But unfortunately, he was at a, you know, Larry was something else, and we came apart. I ended up fighting with him tooth and nail. So
yeah, good, yeah. Good. Okay, yeah. I'll erase that demerit. That's good. Okay, let's transition over to FedWatch, but keep the theme of BlackRock going here. With this is again from the visualist capitalist. Yeah, visual capitalist. I don't know why I'm hung up on that. But what we're looking at is their BlackRock's top equity holdings, a graph of their top equity holdings. This is astonishing, this chart here. Here's their holdings. Look at this. So the blue here, look at the size of that wedge in that pie.
Right. You know, that's Apple huge. Just hit $3 trillion. So BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street are the leaders in the index funds.
Yeah.
And so they're gonna very much, I don't know if this is the stuff they're doing for the ETFs or the asset management or both. But they're gonna end up, because of their prominence in index funds, they're gonna end up with the, you know, whatever the market looks like. They're gonna end up with a pro rata of the market. Apple just hit $3 trillion in market cap.
Well, remember a couple of weeks ago we pointed out that the Nasdaq's up, but it's really being dragged up by a small number of companies. Well, look at this.
There you go.
There are your companies. There's Apple. Right. NVIDIA was in that, and Microsoft was in that. I don't know about Broadcom, but it doesn't really matter. It's a drop in the ocean there.
The subsidy, being engineered into pumping anything that feeds the smart grid is astonishing.
The other thing, and that's what this says here. Information technology, BlackRock is waist deep in information technology, and surprisingly, healthcare, not so much. You know. Anyway, that's an amazing chart to see where BlackRock's where their interest is.
The value of healthcare is what it can deliver in control of the central bankers.
Yeah,
It's not in the fundamental industry itself. Right.
Right. That's true. Yep. Okay, let's keep it going with the story about Hunter Biden. This is just will not get out of the news, and we'll see what the DOJ does with it. But remember, the big thing with Hunter Biden is, you know, he had that laptop, but he lost it, and it comes out on the laptop. Basically, you could, you know, an idiot attorney could make a case that this guy is just selling influence peddling all over the world while his dad is vice president. That's what he's doing, okay, and making a lot of money doing it, tons of money for the family. But let's look at the story as the media would have it.
Let me just stop you for a second, because as a legal matter, I'm assuming what Hunter Biden did, first of all, it's illegal. It's criminally illegal. Taking kickbacks is illegal. But, you know, it could also fall under the conditions of treason as a legal matter.
It's pushing that.
Right.
But certainly it's selling influence, betraying the country's trust for profit is a crime.
Right. Right.
That can rise, you're right, if the buyer has the wrong identity, it can rise to the level of treason. No doubt about that. But it's Hunter Biden, so there's a lot of salacious details that we really lose sight of the ball here. And this Daily Mail story is exactly this. But this gives you a flavor for the kind of people who are in the White House. Daily Mail exclusive, life in the fast lane, reckless Hunter Biden photograph driving himself 172 miles an hour. Let's just go through the pictures. Okay, he picked up his phone to snap a picture while driving to Las Vegas at 172 miles an hour in a Porsche in 2018 because he's going to go meet multiple prostitutes, and this is found on his laptop. So here's Hunter Biden naked in the hotel room. Here he is driving 172 miles an hour. Here he is smoking crack as he drives through a Virginia neighborhood, takes a picture of himself doing that. He's not going 172. He's only going 35 smoking the crack pipe, so I feel a lot better. There's the Porsche. And on, there he is with the hooker telling her, I lost my laptop, another hooker, and on and on and on and on. He nods off behind the wheel, has a crash, then lies to Hertz about the crash and says he was run off the road, lies to the insurance company, lies to the rental car company. Finally, that's not a hooker, that's his daughter. Finally, he gets in front of a prosecutor who's no nonsense about drugs. And she's gonna, you know, she's really big on prosecuting people for CBD and hemp. But on November 16th, she declines to prosecute the case for whatever the reason. Okay, so that's the background on Hunter. No mention at all of selling influence. And now we come to the indictment from the U.S. attorney in Delaware. You can see, so they're not suing him. They're suing him in his home court. So make sure everything goes well. And we got two counts here. Okay, count one is 2017, he had income tax in excess of $100,000. Yes, well, that's what you get when you were selling influence. You make a lot of money doing that. And count two is the same count, really, in 2018. And then there's a separate charge down here for you. You were addicted to a controlled substance and you illegally possessed a firearm. So he's getting a slap on the wrist in his backyard, when the real problem is that his family is a criminal enterprise that sells influence to foreign governments into foreign companies.
Right. So the problem is treason or kickbacks. And to say, you know, you can commit treason and you can sell the country down the river and it's okay as long as you pay your tax. You don't know what to say.
For 2 years. But, you know, the rest of the time, and you know, as a practical matter, this indictment is going to sweep everything under the rug. They're going to say, regardless of what you say about Hunter Biden in the future, they're going to say, we already looked at it. He was prosecuted. Justice has been done. So keep your mouth shut, Pion.
You know, from what I've only been in the country for 2 weeks, John, but from what I've seen, this is not working, though. You know, the normal double down on, oh, you know, the Department of Justice said it wasn't bad, it's been taken care of, all that kind of stuff. It's not working. And that's because people are really struggling with inflation. And they see something like this. And, you know, for them, a certain amount of money is the difference between sending your kids to college and not sending them to college, or life and death, being able to pay for an operation, not being able to pay for an operation. Right. And they're looking at this. And I find most Americans still appreciate productive enterprise. And what they're watching is not, you know, not corruption that's a tithe of 10% on the economy. They're watching corruption that destroys the productivity of economy permanently. And they're looking at the potential for real systemic failure. And they're scared. And so it's not working. There's just too many people coming out of the trance.
Which is a good thing. We need a lot more. I must point out the Republican, if there was ever a situation tailor-made for a special prosecutor, this is it.
Right.
Because the president is knee-deep in this himself. He's a business partner of his son. His son is settling influence peddling through his father. His father is integrally and inextricably wound up in this. And yet Republicans are totally quiet and not saying, hey, don't we need a special prosecutor to look at this?
Here's why.
You're the head of the DOJ. Aren't you self-interested in what the DOJ is and is not doing with your son? But nope, not peep from the Republicans.
Right. But here's the horrible reality we're all facing. If you look at the information that is publicly available on the financial management of the government and the information that is publicly available on the Ukraine, the entire Congress and the White House are engaged openly in creating treason, in committing treason.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's right out in the open. And they're knee-deep in Ukraine, too, which is part of that laptop story.
Right. So we have a systemic institution of treasonous behavior. And the question for all of us is, okay, what if it's really that bad, what are we going to do about it? And the good news this week is we're about to go into a series of stories about judges who've decided, you know, you have a whole professional class who for some reason have now decided, okay, we can do something about this and we are going to do something about this. So
we're starting to see signs of that. My point about Republicans isn't, you know, Republicans bad, Democrats. It's that the notion that there's two parties is ridiculous. There's a uniparty, and it does whatever the criminal class wants it to do. And in this case, it's going to keep its mouth shut and not even breathe the word special prosecutor or independent counsel. Or
right, but remember, a lot of those people are afraid for their lives. It's not just corruption. It's not just that they're on the take.
You know what? We need to take one for the team party, which says I do the wrong thing, even if I got to take one for the team.
Right. Exactly.
Yep. Nobody's going to do that. And so without the moral courage, we're just not going to go anywhere with any of this.
Well, the revolution was in the minds of the people. Let's see if we can change our mind.
Let's hope so. Okay. Let's go to the judges and some better news. Supreme Court gets rid of affirmative actions in college admission. Affirmative action is gone. Colleges and universities can no longer use race as a factor in their admissions decisions. The Supreme Court ruled on Thursday, striking down the decades-long practice. The court ruled affirmative action, it violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, which is kind of obvious and has been for a long time, but hey, better late than never. Crucial quote, students must be treated based on his or her experiences as an individual, not on the basis of race. Many universities have for too long done just the opposite, Roberts wrote, and in so doing, they have concluded wrongly that the touchstone of an individual's identity is not challenges best in skills built or lessons learned, but the color of their skin. couple surprises in this ruling here. Surprising fact number one, the decision does not apply to military academies. We'll get to the military in a minute. And number two, this surprised me, 41.5%. That's the approximate percentage of U.S. universities that take race into account when determining admissions. I think that might be a little on the low side.
Looks low. So how do you know, if you strategically, if you think about this, how do we get rid of affirmative action across the board? This is just colleges. So how do we get rid of it in business? Because if you look at the compliant costs of affirmative action, you know, I can't tell you how much time and money this is wasted in business, particularly small business.
Well, so, attorneys, you know, Supreme Court's obviously it's a very important institution. And believe you me, there are tons of attorneys and tons of clients right now looking like, hey, how can we use that decision to our own advantage? The litigation train has just begun.
You think, okay, well, that's good news, because I think there's a lot of unbelievably expensive and wasteful compliance that needs to get blown out. So
I agree. I agree. I can't imagine what that's like, that compliance. I can, from having worked in the law firm and seeing kind of a global law firm and sort of the hoops it would go through to comply. It was just kind of...
So Hamilton Securities was a government contractor, and I spent a fortune of time and money dealing with this. And it was interesting because it was a, you know, it was a constant war. And I remember twice different, we were a broker dealer, and different state and different entities tried to put us in municipal bond deals where we would get a check. And I said, no, we won't do it. And they said, well, you're eligible because you're a woman-owned firm, and we'll just send you a check. You don't have to do anything. And I said, I refuse to take money for doing nothing. It's just corrupt. And what was interesting is one of the states we turned down, ultimately, there was a big investigation of firms, you know, minority-owned or women-owned firms taking checks and doing nothing. So we ducked that one, but it was a very expensive, wasteful process. And we used to constantly get dinged because we refused to have an affirmative action plan. We always stayed less than 50. And the big firms like First Boston Price Waterhouse would get the 10 points because they had these, I mean, they had whole departments and experts and compliance and, you know, and it was all complete yaya.
Most of which is perception management, which is what I saw inside my law firm. It's like, you know, it's a nice game of corporate twister you have going there, but it's just you're manufacturing illusions to keep up profits and to satisfy people on the outside. And that's all you're doing. There's nothing real has changed. We both know that.
Here was my problem. You know, a corporation being good for women, you know, a company like a J.P. Morgan Chase could engage in predatory lending that would destroy families and, you know, mothers with kids and promote all sorts of things that poison us and be horrible for women and their families. And then because they hired lots of women from Harvard Business School, they're great for women. How can that be great for women?
That's not. It's the answer to that. It's perception management again.
Right. So there was an unreality. There's always been an unreality to it that, to me, I find frightening.
Yeah, right.
Right.
That unreality has gotten a lot bigger in the last few decades. But
right.
Hey, you know, like I say, better late than never with that decision. Let's turn to the military, though, since that story did bring up the military. And this is the first of two stories where it's like, hey, why don't you look inside instead of blaming the outside world? Anyway, from the Wall Street Journal, here we go. The military recruiting crisis. Even veterans don't want their families to join. That doesn't sound good. The children of military families make up the majority of new recruits in the U.S. military. That pipeline is now under threat, which is bad news to the Pentagon's already acute recruitment problems, as well as America's readiness. Influencers are not telling them to go into the military, says Admiral Mike Mullen, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Moms and dads, uncles, coaches, pastors don't see it as a good choice. Here you go. Here's the deal. After a patriotic boost to recruiting that followed 9/11, the U.S. military has endured 20 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan with no decisive victories. No decisive victories is one way of putting it. Humiliating defeat would be another. That might be a problem. Not only that, only 9% of young people ages 16 to 21 said last year they would even consider military service, down from 13% before the pandemic. And also keep in mind that a lot of these young people, they're not going to pass the ASVAB, the Armed Services Vocational Right. Aptitude Battery, and they're not in shape. So you have that too. But yeah, here we go. What are defense officials going to do about it? They're saying they're not doing a good job of battling what they call misperceptions. They said many families want their children to go on to higher education after high school, considering the military as a stumbling block instead of a stepping stone. So they're blaming, there's like, well, it's perception. That's the only problem. Not us, perception.
So 2 points. When Denny Rancor first did his look at the rise of all-cause mortality coming out of the, you know, after the injections, you know, to everyone's surprise, one of the biggest rise of all-cause mortality was in the southern states, where the military recruits and gets most of their, you know, most of the people who join voluntarily. And the rise was there in the age group that would normally go into the military. So you're talking about young men in the 7 southern states that provide recruits to the military, and they have one of the highest rises, that cohort, of all-cause mortality. And don't think that that's not part of this.
Yeah.
That's definitely. Now, so you have
the military even calls that region the Southern Smile because of the shape of the swath it makes across the southern U.S.
Right. So the DOD is distributing bioweapons in the Southern Smile that just happened to trigger the rise of all-cause mortality in the very kids they need to recruit. And then they're saying they're having trouble recruiting. Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, at the same time, I just finished watching a detailed description by Kennedy, who spent 3 days at the border looking at immigration. And he said, okay, 7 million people I've come across, I don't know if it's the last year or so far this year, a lot of them are coming in from Africa and Asia, you know, Kazakhstan and sort of the stands. And somebody has arranged for them to come all the way to Mexico so they can just walk across the border. And he says, the borders are open. Wow. They're just walking across. But what you've got is a lot of military age young men. And I think what's going to happen is they're going to find a way, you know, because it used to be that you could sign up and if you were Mexican, you'd come over, join the Navy. And, you know, by serving in the Navy for a certain period of time, you would win your citizenship. And my guess is part of that immigration pipeline they're going to use to fill up the army with non-Americans.
Wow. Wow. Well, we'll see.
Time will tell.
All right. The next blame someone other than yourself story is from Macron in France. He demands platforms delete riot content, blame social media and video games for protest spread. There he is, a little rendition of Macron with the Paris is burning in the background. Here's what he says. He pleads the social media giants to erase the most sensitive content pertaining to the rioting. And these are quotes from Macron. Right. Platforms or networks are playing a major role in the events of recent days. Okay? We've seen them. Snapchat, TikTok, and several others serve as places where violent gatherings have been organized. But there's also a form of mimicry of the violence which for some young people leads them to lose touch with reality. You get the impression that some of them are experiencing on the street the video games that have intoxicated them. So that's the problem, that we have all these problems on the street because suddenly people have been intoxicated by video games and are just acting out the video games on the street.
It has nothing to do with him changing the pension fund age or cutting various benefits or inflation.
Or refusing to listen to the yellow vest for year after year after year. Nothing to do with that at all.
Right.
Nope.
My guess is if you had an honest poll in France, Macron's approval rating would be less than 10%. Yeah. It would be phenomenal. Right.
Right. He'd be out. Right.
Right.
That's the truth. Okay. This is the last story we have in FedWatch. This is from Toby Rogers. This is a really interesting thought piece. How then shall we think about the economy? It's worth reading the whole thing. I just want to touch on a couple of high points. The real story here, the United States has undergone a radical economic restructuring over the last few decades. It's now organized around producing poison, pharma, pesticides, plastics, frankenfood. So poison is one. So it produces poison, It produces war, military contracts. It produces energy, oil, natural gas, and forgetting. That's the, it's other industries, forgetting. The big media industries that produce stories that narcotize society into ignoring how bad things are. And against the backdrop of all this, big finance is behind all of it. Big industries own the political and regulatory system we are now living under, a new form of fascism. But it's really a new form of fascism because it's not a partnership between industry and government, but a government as a wholly owned subsidiary of industry. And then he goes on, he touches on this point of the narcotization and media's role in this. Because the primary industries in the U.S. produce poison and misery, the ruling class requires a vast cultural system to produce ongoing amnesia about our situation. So countless streaming services and social media companies figure out how to capture our attention 24/7, 365, so that we never actually stop and think about what is being done to us. Endless shows about doctors and pandemic and movies that dramatize the lives of CIA-type operatives glorify the very industries that make us miserable, and that is a dynamite point.
Right. One of the things I love what Toby Rogers is doing, and I think this is a great piece. Right now, you have millions of Americans struggling, you know, going to the doctor and they're on this medical treadmill, and they haven't, as a matter of consciousness, realized, oh, I'm not sick, I'm being poisoned, and not only that, I can reverse it. But they need, you know, they're never going to hear that from their doctor, and they're never going to get that consciousness until they connect the dots. You know, once you have that, suddenly you have a whole new way of dealing with it, which is far more effective than staying on the pharmaceutical and medical treadmill. You got to get off that treadmill. But first of all, you've got to see, oh, yeah, it's a healthcare problem, but it's also a political problem, and it can be fixed. There is a great deal that people within a community or a county can do to completely turn this around. But they've got to see that they're part of a general poisoning as opposed to, oh, I have a health problem. These are not individual health problems. You know, they are symptoms of a general poisoning. And the real solutions come when you get that consciousness. So anyway.
Yeah.
I feel, as you can tell, I feel very strongly about this.
Yeah.
What's story after Toby Rogers?
Well, we go to Ukraine.
Yep. Let's go to Ukraine.
Okay, let's shift gears and go to the war in the Ukraine. Obviously the story of the hour, and really the story of the fortnight, was the attempted coup by Prigozhin over the Wagner group, which failed. And so there are a couple different takes we want to look at here from two people we've seen on this program before. One is Pepe Escobar. We'll leave with him an article in Strategic Culture. And he says, when the lightning of history strikes, better cut to the chase in our first draft. Not really sure what that headline's all about, but Escobar says, President Putin wins on all counts. Among other feats, he has made an absolute intergalactic ass out of the whole collective Western mainstream medium all over again. He rallied virtually every Russian to end the special military operation, or almost war, according to some business circles, quicker. So in other words, he's not going to end the military involvement. He's just ending this, and he's going to step it up, and they're going to move to the next level. As much as Putin helped perennial Lukashenko in August 2020, preventing the regime change. So that's really the key here, because Prigozhin ends up, you know, in Belarus. So what really happened after the longest day? Here's what Pepe Escobar says. Hefty CIA funds may have changed hands, but in the end, the coup would not turn out, or could turn out, to be the greatest Russian trolling of the West ever. Meaning Putin was really waiting for these guys. Here's the big mystery, though. The exact terms of the deal between Lukashenko and Prigozhin, because remember, Prigozhin is going to Belarus, where Lukashenko is the leader. The exact terms of that deal, with help from the governor of the Tula region, are still unclear. And that's the key. It's like, so what is the deal? Everybody wants to know, like, why didn't Putin, you know, why did he just execute this guy? Because it was treason.
Right.
What's the deal with this guy going to Belarus? But keep in mind the backdrop.
Well, he's going to Belarus at the same time tactical nukes are going to Belarus.
That's true. That's one thing. But remember, Escobar points out, Putin did a big favor for Lukashenko in 2020, kind of right. helped him out quite a bit. And now I want to turn to the other take for another guy we've seen on this channel before. This is from Indian Punchline, and this guy, Badru Kumar, we've seen him. I like him a lot. He's very clear, very sober. Here's his kind of read on the situation. The Russian authorities were waiting for Prigozhin to make his move. Russian intelligence kept a strong presence right inside the Wagner tent. So they saw it coming, he says. The crucial element in the deal struck with Prigozhin has been that he will not be prosecuted, but simply must get lost. And where else could his exile be arranged better on planet Earth than in Belarus under the benevolent eyes of President Alexander Lukashenko? And here's what he says. This is the key point way down here. Make no mistake, Lukashenko will eventually make Prigozhin sing, sooner rather than later, and the song will be transmitted live to the Kremlin. And that accounts for the great nervousness in Washington, which has raised the specter of nuclear war to give the spin to distract attention away from the CIA's plot to destabilize Russia. What lies ahead is the manifestation of the steely resolve of the Kremlin and Putin himself to seek an all-out military solution to the Ukraine crisis, not just a special military operation anymore. Putin declared this week, almost likely in anticipation of the storm brewing on the horizon, that war will be over when no Ukrainian army will be left on the battlefield or NATO weapons left either. So this is it. This is the swan song for what's going on in the right. Ukraine. He's getting serious now.
So CIA came out and said they had no involvement, which is very hard to believe. And especially when your satellites are going overhead. So,
yeah.
You know, so I still don't think we know the true story here.
No.
But, you know, the only lesson I take away from it is beware mercenary armies.
Yeah, that's a big one.
They can be bought and they can be bought away.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
That's right. You got to think that Russia's rethinking that one now. No. But right. Who knows? It's hard to second guess these guys.
I had a very scary moment last week about the Ukraine. I was watching a campaign debate here in the United States, and the host of the show was very much promoting the official narrative on the Ukraine and the notion that we would have 320,000 Ukrainian soldiers killed to promote our plan to destabilize Russia. It was as though those lives didn't matter. It was a video game.
Right.
And you realized we're talking about a level of psychopathy as culture that is frightening. That's 320,000 young men dying was of no consequence or had no meaning to this host.
Right. They might as well have been ordering sandwiches off a menu.
Right. It was the banana nut muffin recipe again.
Yeah.
You described last week. And it was scary because they, you don't know if they're in a trance and they're mind controlled or they just, you know, it was like watching the movie They Live. It was scary because there are going to be consequences to that attitude. And that attitude's been getting worse for 50 years. And now it's in full bloom and there are going to be real consequences.
Yeah. The other part of it is that you're getting a lower and lower quality at the presidential level. I wish I had saved this picture of Blinken in China. He looks like a scolded schoolboy.
Right.
You know, over there next to Xi Jinping. These people, they're out of their depth. They're out of their league now.
Right.
Because of the low quality at the top, the low quality that comes with getting people who are psychopaths, who are that level of psychopathy is exactly right.
Or yes men. I mean, you've got, well, I told you, you know, I watched that interview of Obama. I'm trying to find it where it's the first one I'd seen of him in a long time, and he's scared. I mean, and when I watched it, it was clear to me they don't have an exit. You know, no. They don't have a plan B for the Ukraine, and they're in real trouble. If you look at how scared he was, that's a man whose plan has failed, and he's in trouble.
Okay, so let's go to the last story in War in the Ukraine and see what the psychopath's response to this to the coup is going to be now that Putin has emerged victorious. From the Wall Street Journal, Well, they're going to double down. That's what they're going to do. U.S. close to approving long-range missiles to bolster Ukraine's fight. The U.S. is close to approving long-range missile system for Ukraine that could shift. It could shift the tide of the fight against Russian invaders. So again, you know, we know that's not going well for people, despite the propaganda. But these new missiles have a range of about 190 miles, enough for Ukrainian forces to strike Russian targets far behind front lines. Now, that'll fix everything. Long-range missiles are needed in part to strike into Crimea, the peninsula occupied by Russia, that Russian forces are using as a base to launch Iranian-made drones. So the psychopaths are doubling down. This didn't work. The coup didn't work. So we're going to put missiles in and see if this works. We'll just keep doubling down at the roulette table until eventually we'll hit the winning bet.
So I don't see how this helps. If you don't have boots on the ground that can command the field, long-range missiles are not going to help. You know,
right.
The theory is they will cause a group of, you know, the military in Russia to revolt against Putin and get rid of Putin. You know, and I cannot believe the Russian military would be that dumb to think, you know, because getting rid of Putin is just step one to destabilizing the whole place. So, you know, who wants to do that again if you're Russian?
Right. You don't.
Right. So we're, you know, we're in a game of chicken and these guys don't have a face-saving way out. So this is a dangerous time.
It's a dangerous time. I don't think they're ever going to put boots on the ground. They're smart enough to see, you know, this Russian army has ground through three armies.
Right.
We don't want them to grind through a NATO army. You know, we'll let them grind through the meatball sandwiches from the Ukraine, but not our own boys. We can't do that. So we're just going to keep, you know, adding weapons and just hope, cross our fingers and hope for the best. They're just getting checkmated every turn by a superior military and a superior commander.
So
that's kind of a straightforward story.
Right. You know, but an inferior media. The Russians have not out-media them yet.
Right, no.
So I just want to point out, it's now July 5th that we're recording. This publishes on July 6th. We are coming in, so we've had a big holiday in the U.S. We're coming into the Bohemian Grove this month, where if they don't have a plan B, there's no way people go to the Grove and leave the Grove without a plan B. You know, a plan B is going to emerge one way or the other. Now, you have the BRIC nations, Russia and China. So we have all sorts of move of different countries now paying for Russian oil with Chinese yuan. And there have been all these announcements of, you know, Argentina paying the IMF with Chinese yuan because they don't have enough dollars to pay off their loan. So we have all these sort of currency announcements. The BRICS get together in South Africa in August. And there's been a big debate whether they're going to move the meeting to China because there is an international warrant out for Putin. So the question is, will the South Africans be obligated by treaty to exercise the warrant? But anyway, so the meeting is going to be in South Africa, and there are big issues in terms of Russia, China, and other people impacted by the sanctions and the trade around the sanctions, talking about whether or not the BRICS are going to come out with their own currency. So, you know, and whether they do or not, there's going to be a lot of conversations about how do we build resiliency against the empire. So if you look at the series of meetings this summer before the fall, you know, between now and the end of September, there are a tremendous amount of meetings of the empire getting together and saying, okay, what's our plan B? And the BRICS nations coming together and saying, okay, how do we deal with it now? And what's our, you know, what will their plan be and what will our response be?
Yeah.
And the, you know, the tear in the fabric is accelerating.
Yeah.
Right.
It really is. I think you're exactly right. But they've realized we might have bitten off more than we can chew here. You know, we didn't have really success against even the Afghanistan army. Now we're up against a peer adversary and we're getting our ass handed to us bad. What do we do? Oh boy,
well,
what do we do about this one?
I think a lot of people would say Afghanistan was a huge success because of how much money they made. In other words, you always want to preserve your brand as a democracy, so you get beat by the guy in sandals, but meantime you've made $20 trillion and stolen another $10 trillion. Do you know what I mean?
Well, so you were chased out in a humiliating way, and your weapons ended up in the hands of your longtime nemesis. That's hard to sell as a win. They know. Let me ask you this. You poll 100 military people. How many people try to sell Afghanistan as a win?
I look at it financially. So for the guys making money, you know, who ends up with the resources, really? That's the question. You know, oil and natural resources and minerals in Afghanistan, you know, when we pull out, who controls, who ends up with them?
Let me ask
question
you this.
Question mark.
Military is going to go up against an adversary. You look at your last war against Afghanistan, which you lost, and now you're going to go up against a bigger opponent. How do you like your odds? You like them or you don't like them?
Right now, NATO has zero chance of beating the Russian army.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. The odds are zero.
Right.
And there's suddenly that pill has gone down the esophagus and they're tasting it like this is not good.
Well, here's the question. If you look at the weapons that I think we have that are invisible weaponry or rod of God, the question is how do those weapons do up against Russia? Because they got secret weapons, we got secret weapons, we've got satellites, they've got satellites. I don't know how that works out, but I know if it depends on a standing army, NATO has zero chance.
Well, the pudding tastes like shit. So your miracle ingredient sauce, right. it's not looking very credible right now.
Well, but here's the thing. Traditionally, the strategy of just outspending them and out-enduring them has always worked. It can't work now because you don't have the ability to endure that outspending.
Right, right.
Right,
right.
So
you don't have any ammo. Your spending can't make ammo. Can't do
you
it.
You have ammo, but you don't have the ammo it takes to do this for 10 years.
No. We don't have the ammo. That's the problem.
No, the financial ammo.
The U.S. does not have. No, I'm talking about artillery, like ammo. They're out of ammo. You can't. Yeah, I don't care how much money you have.
Well, but don't you know the Chinese are going to, continue to supply us with the ammo we need to fight with them, right?
Are they? Have you asked Xi Jinping about that? It seems like he's more on Russia's side. They're out of ammo, and Russia's not. Remember, these are the people who told you sanctions are going to bankrupt Russia. It's going to turn the ruble into rubble. You know, it's going to crush their whole economy. None of these things have happened. They have low inflation. They're on top. They have plenty of ammo, and their economy is doing just fine.
Right. They do have a long-term demographic problem. They do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they
yeah.
do.
They get a long-term military problem, which is it started out bad, and it's getting worse, and it's getting worse by the day.
Right. The Russians have a long-term demographic problem. They really do. They really do. And that's part of what these guys are betting on. But they don't have I don't think they have the financial clout to see that kind of strategy through.
The financial clout's irrelevant. You don't have ammo. You're out of ammo. You can't fire guns, period. There's no amount of dollars that you're going to fix that. These guys are there. They're toast. Bohemian Grove is going to be interesting. Plan B, I can't wait. I wait with bated breath.
I would love to be in the room. I would love to be at the Mandalay camp with you listening to the whole conversation. Wouldn't that be fun?
That'd be awesome, yeah. All right, let's turn to Hey Robot with an interesting story about what's going on in crypto. Remember, the SEC has been clamping down hard on crypto, so this story kind of comes as a surprise, but kind of not. Wall Street Journal, crypto exchange backed by Citadel Securities, Fidelity Schwab starts operation. Citadel, of course, being the high-frequency trading firm where Ben Bernanke now works, and Fidelity and Schwab, sort of the old line investment brokerage houses. The launch shows that some Wall Street firms remain interested in crypto despite, or perhaps because of, a regulatory onslaught by the SEC and a market that has cooled off over the last 18 months. EDX is the name of the exchange, and it says it differs in key ways from normal crypto exchanges. Number one, it doesn't directly handle customers' digital assets. Instead, it runs a marketplace where firms agree to execute trades of coins and dollars, using its platform really only to agree on prices. Then the firms move crypto and cash between each other to settle the trades. Another difference is that unlike most crypto exchanges, EDX won't directly serve individual investors. Instead, it expects that retail brokerages will send investors orders to buy and sell digital coins to the marketplace. So in other words, that's why Schwab is in there.
Right.
The stock market operates in under a similar model. So they're copying the stock market model. EDX chief executive Jamal Nasrallah, that's the name of the guy. He was a longtime executive at Citadel Securities before joining EDX. And looky here, it will offer trading in just four cryptocurrencies: Bitcoin, Ether, Litecoin, and Bitcoin Cash, none of which have been identified as securities by the SEC. How about that?
So much less regulation.
Yeah.
Less regulation, yeah.
Yeah. So let's go to let's look at a chart if you want to right now.
As we talked about the last time we were on, this is, we're watching, see that? So this is an old, from the going direct reset vote in 2019. So we see the pump coming into the pandemic, and then we see the dump that we experienced with the pandemic being over. And now we're watching rises again. So it hit the floor, and right at the bottom is when BIS came out and took a series of regulatory positions that suddenly sort of put a floor. Because if you looked at the charts at that point, I was expecting it to go down to as low as 9,000.
But so this is 16,000 here, right?
Yeah, BIS puts a floor under it, and it starts to come back. And now what we see this recent jump right up at the end?
That's
over
doubled
on the right.
But
this, what this is the clear indication from both BlackRock and now Schwab and Fidelity that you have an institutional advancement, if you will, and making, as they make these cryptos available and Bitcoin available through a discount brokerage, you are going to see a tsunami of money pour in. So we could go back to that peak and higher, literally.
I think that's exactly right. And if you look at a chart, remember the four were Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash.
Right.
Bitcoin Cash has that one went from 24 to 32, the chart we were just looking at.
Right.
24,000, 32,000. Bitcoin Cash has doubled in that same time.
Right.
So, the Citadel is the whale in the pond now.
Right.
I said, Ben Bernanke works at the Citadel.
Well, here's the question. How much money are they planning on directing in? And if they direct in a lot of retail discount brokerage capital and retirement savings capital, they can pump this thing to the moon. So beware, beware how you, this is a speculation. So beware.
Yeah.
There's going to be a dump on the other side of this. So if they pump it, just understand what you're playing with here.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Okay, let's go to the next story.
I would like to point, when they pump this, it will make it easier for the central bankers to get more gold because everybody will be distracted into the pump. And so if you want to control real assets, it's a brilliant strategy to get all the retail money chasing the digital asset while you command and get control of the real.
They might be a little late to that party if the BRICS have anything to say about it.
Yeah. No, well, this is designed for the Western consumer.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Right.
All right. Next story in crypto, really, and hey, Robot, from The Telegraph. This is Britcoin, not Bitcoin, Britcoin. Sunak, the Prime Minister of UK, he has ambitions, but they are hit by a huge public backlash. So Britcoin is not doing so well over in the UK. Sunak's ambition to turn UK into a digital currency hub has been dealt a blow following a public backlash, as more than 50,000 responses to a joint consultation with the Treasury on the introduction of a central bank digital currency. When people respond in numbers like that, the response is not in favor, it's opposition, right?
Right.
Okay, so let's go down. They quote all these people, they go back and forth to the history of this, and then we come to the loss of support among this guy. Look at this. Central bank digital currency, CBDC, have also drawn the ire of a former bank governor, Lord King. And I must say, that's one hell of an intimidating power name right there. Lord King has branded them a solution without a problem that have risks but no obvious benefits. He cautioned against creating something the public didn't need just because it had the sexy name of a digital currency. Lord King means Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England from 2003 and 2013. Now Lord King, he's been knighted or something.
Mervyn King's in serious danger of becoming Solari Hero of the Week.
Yeah, he also threw the Fed under the bus last year, or maybe a couple years ago, on causing inflation.
He said,
yeah,
well,
of course the U.S. Yeah. He says, of course the U.S. have inflation. You guys, you bought all these assets and you increased the ordinary money supply. That's where inflation's coming from.
Right. So
so now that he's no longer governor, he speaks the truth.
Right. Well, he wrote a book after he left that was remarkably candid and very useful. And then he's been getting more and more honest. And I think my impression of King is he understands the benefits of financial liquidity, and he knows if you destroy them, what's going to happen. Yeah. And he knows that's where they're headed, and it's a terrible, terrible mistake.
Right.
So the reason I loved looking at this story is if you look at the Cato poll that says only 16% of Americans want CBDC, and then you look at the backlash in Britain, what you were seeing in the Anglo-American Alliance is the professional class has gotten onto, you know, the financial repression strategy, and they don't want it. And they are adamant. They see this coming, and they are no.
Right.
And it's significant. I mean, it's above that 80% mark. You got 80%, and you have too many smart people who have real, you know, who have real professional clout, and their attitude is, I mean, you've got the president of the Minneapolis Fed saying, don't do this. You've got the former governor of the Bank of England saying, don't do this.
Right. Right. It's a bridge too far. You know?
It's a bridge too far. So you got Powell saying now he's going to do it on a wholesale basis. But I think he's got, you know, to do this, if he needs legislation to do it on a wholesale basis, he's still got a food fight in front of him.
We will see. You know, I wonder about that. You know, I watched some testimony of Powell, and I don't know. They're not asking the right questions. Anyway.
I don't know. I think Powell's slow walking it.
Yeah, he is. But the question is why. I don't think Congress is high on Powell's list of impediments.
No.
Something else.
Well, but here's the problem. Congress may not be opposed and on his list of impediments, but if you try and get legislation through, then everybody gets clear about who makes money, who wins and who loses, and you get food fights.
Yeah,
and so even if Congress is not an impediment, you end up with all sorts of food fights that could kill you.
You know, I think you're exactly right. I think popularly among people, the ordinary people understand this is bad news bears, stay away. What I don't think we have is a voice in Congress to sort of give expression to the public opposition to CBDC. I just don't see that anywhere in Congress. I see people kind of making the right noise in the right direction, but there's no one really, they're all kind of missing key.
I agree. Nobody has yet emerged.
Yeah, nobody's emerged, so we'll see.
Right.
Okay, but let's turn to Farmageddon. There's four very interesting stories this week, all for different reasons. We'll start with this one from Resist, the mainstream, a publication I'm not familiar with and it doesn't permit highlighting. But here we have a basketball player who blamed COVID vaccine for his heart condition, dies of a heart attack. And he says, many people warned me. This is a professional basketball player in the Dominican Republic. Oscar Adames died this week after an apparent heart attack. He says, okay, so after he dies, social media posts come out in which he comes right out and says, he developed a rare heart disease after he receives 2 doses of COVID vaccines. I got a damn myocarditis from taking the effing vaccine. I got 2 doses of Pfizer and I knew it. Many people warned me, he said. He also said the vaccine was a work requirement. He says, but guess what? It was compulsory or I couldn't work. I'm an international professional athlete. I'm playing in Spain. I have no health problems, nothing, not hereditary, nothing. I suddenly collapsed to the ground in the middle of a match and almost died. I'm recovering and I've had 11 different cardiology tests done. And guess what? they find nothing, and then he dies. So they don't find anything wrong, and then the guy dies. So it's just the medical community there, you see it in action, burying its head in the sand, saying, well, we can't find a damn thing.
So you know? Did he die from the injection, or did he die from talking about the injection? I'll be a tough guy.
I think he probably from the injection.
It could have also been from talking too much about the injection.
Either way, it could be. Let's just keep going with the stories, because you know, again, it's a pack of four very interesting stories, and we'll come back to the possibility that maybe he died from talking about the injection. That's a distinct possibility,
right?
But we will see. Okay, next story is from Washington Examiner. This is interesting. New emails show COVID vaccine mandates were based on a lie. This time we're talking about Walensky at the, where is she? She's the CDC. The FOIA request shows that CDC Director Rochelle Walensky and NIH Director Francis Collins were aware of and discussed breakthrough cases of COVID in January of 2021. So they knew that even people who took the vaccine could still have what's called breakthrough cases, meaning that the vaccine didn't work, and they knew it didn't work in January of 2021. Okay? In her email, Walensky says that clearly it's an important area of study and links to a study raising the issue, and assures the person she is sending it to that Anthony Fauci is looped into these conversations. However, in public, Walensky was saying something quite different. 2 months after that email, she was discussing this data, saying vaccinated people don't carry the virus and don't get sick. So that's a lie. She knows it was a lie. Then she says, after it became clear that people were able to get infected with COVID even after receiving the vaccine, she defended her original statements by claiming it was true at the time she said it, namely that the strands we were dealing with in early 2021. But now we know that she was lying. So she lied when she said that vaccinated people don't get COVID. And now we know that she was lying when she said, oh, no, you know, I didn't know that at the time, but she did know that she did know. The emails prove that.
So on July 3rd, I went down to Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia. You know, Carpenter's Hall was one of the buildings where it was where Benjamin Franklin negotiated the alliance with the French, with the French spy. So it was all part of the revolutionary. Anyway, there was a concert on the Independence Mall afterwards, and people were sitting around waiting for an hour for the concert to begin. And then the Park Service person got up and canceled it. It was a young woman who was the interim director for the Independence Mall. And she opened her speech and she said, nothing is more important to the, you know, to the government than your safety. And the whole crowd just looked at her like, you poor young person, you have not a clue. I've never seen a statement fall flat worse than that. And then she proceeded to cancel the concert. And because there were going to be thunderstorms in an hour, Vanessa Williams came out and wanted to sing God Bless America, and they wouldn't permit it because there was going to be a thunderstorm an hour from now, and they had to cancel the concert. It was beyond Bart. But when she said, nothing is more important than your safety, the crowd just looked at her like, really? Really?
Yeah.
But you look at Walensky, and I've read several stories about this issue. I've always wanted to look at Walensky and say, how many people were you hoping to kill? What was your target?
Right. You knew the vaccine didn't work and you lied about it.
Right.
So why were you pushing it? And why were you pushing it? And you were lying to push it. That's
right. But I would love to know exactly how much she got paid, not just in her position, but kickbacks behind the scenes. I want to know how much money she got paid for each person killed or disabled.
I got to figure it's a lot. But let's keep going with these other stories. There's two more stories in the pipeline that really add some more depth to this. Okay, this is the next one's from Igor's newsletter. I don't know this. This is a Substack. Italian doctor suspended for suggesting autopsies of sudden deaths. How about that? Someone dies suddenly. Hey, let's have an autopsy. Nope, right. Not a good idea now. Italian doctor Valerio Paterli was publicly asked about sudden deaths. He suggested that sudden deaths of adults are on the rise and recommended doing more autopsies to discover why people are dying unexpectedly. For this suggestion, he was suspended for 2 months. Okay? He was concerned about the increase in deaths from myocardial infarction and the need to perform more autopsies to get the causes. And he points to this graph, and it's kind of hard to see, but this is excess deaths, okay? Excess right. mortality, you see it right there? And these numbers here, this is 17,000 and this is 11,000 here. So you can see right. that through all weeks of 2022, for all weeks you had tens and thousands of excess deaths, right?
Right.
Okay. And he's not alone, okay? He's not alone in getting punished. When a brave British parliamentarian, Andrew Bridgen, and we covered him a couple weeks ago, suggested that excess deaths in the UK were a national emergency, he himself was falsely accused of anti-Semitism. Matt Hancock, a mastermind of British lockdowns, and Rishi Sunak, a World Economic Forum member who profited mightily from COVID vaccine companies, were at the forefront of these false accusations. So that gets back to your point of, well, since the COVID industry and since the injection industry is willing to punish people who question the narrative, was the Dominican basketball player, in fact, murdered for talking about the vaccine as opposed to just dying from being vaccinated?
Right. And I'm going to bring up a couple others because we just had award ceremonies in Italy. And our hero of the week, Antoinette Gatti, was one of the award winners. There were two French doctors there, one of which, both very healthy, one of which suddenly had a heart attack and died, and one which had a stroke and is apparently going to make it. But people are exceptionally suspicious, and it follows Arne Burkhardt's death. You know, a month or so ago, again, people are very concerned and suspicious. There's no doubt that the pathologists pose the greatest danger to the official narrative. Because anytime a pathologist, you know, someone like Burkhardt or Ryan Cole has looked at what's really going on in the body, they're proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that they're being killed by the injections.
Yeah.
Yep.
My hunch is, and it's just a hunch, that's what went on with the DR basketball player.
Right.
Because his problems were so acute leading up to this,
right.
There was no need to kill him. You just let the vaccine do what it was going to do anyway.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely could have been. But what I see is again, I've only been here for 2 weeks, the grind of deaths and disability and the lies coming out, more and more people are understanding that something very, very wrong has happened. So,
yeah, okay. And with that in mind, I want to go to the fourth and final story. This story, the more I think about it, this is far and away the most important story of the four, and this is the story of the week to me. This is from Children's Health Defense. Bombshell study of Pfizer COVID vaccine suggests some people got highly dangerous shots, others got a placebo. There's right. a lot. It's not very much coverage here, but there's a lot to think about. Let me show you what's going on. Danish scientists uncovered compelling evidence that a significant percentage of the batches of Pfizer vaccine distributed in the EU likely consisted of placebos. Interesting. Batches of Pfizer vaccine can neatly be divided into three groups, okay? And here they are. Two of the three groups demonstrated higher than normal percentages of severe adverse events in recipients. However, for a third group of batches, a total of zero adverse events were reported, okay? So now you might say, as I was like, well, maybe it's a small number of batches in that third group with the placebos, but it isn't. It's a big number. Take a look
right.
at this. Up to 30% were placebos, meaning the vaccines were fake, okay? That number right there, just that 30% are placebos, that means there really was, to me, there was no pandemic at all. The whole thing was fake, and the vaccine is done for something other than curing a disease, right?
Well, it's my best guess is it's experiment. One, you're running multiple experiments, but two, you've got a quota system. And if you look at the rise in all-cause mortality, there's enormous differentiation geographically. And so the question is, were batches targeted in a quota system?
Yes, they were. And we're going to see that. Let's go back to
right.
the story. But the 30% number means that you don't care about people and you're not worried about people at all since you're giving them placebos, number
right.
one. Number two, if it was a real disease, you would have done placebos in testing and you didn't. You're rushing this thing out. But let's look at the graph. The graph is the real tell about what's going on here. Look at this. this graph here. So here you see the three different doses. This is placebos, so no adverse reactions. It's all just buried right there on the x-axis. Then a second group of batches where you have some adverse events, but not many. And then here, here are your kill shots. You just need just the smallest of dose to give you the bad reaction. That tells
this,
me, though, too.
This fits entirely with Sasha Ladipova and the bad batch group, what they found. This kind
tells
of variability.
Me that we're not done with mRNA and we're not done with vaccines. There's another pandemic coming. This is the experiment to see, okay, how do we wipe people out? And we're going to monitor them. And that graph, that pretty much proves it. That they're monitoring this on an ongoing basis. They got placebos out there now.
Right. So, and this is not just, this shows disability or death. It doesn't show sterility. And that's another big question mark, because if you look at the sort of information that's coming in, we just saw a fabulous presentation by a Swiss doctor at Doctors for COVID Ethics about what's happening to fertility in Switzerland among the injected. And it's astonishing the drop in healthy babies.
Yeah.
Right.
That's astonishing. But that graph, that's a breathtaking graph.
Mm-hmm.
That there's, because the fact that there's a big percentage of those shots, they were kill shots, and they're out there killing people. And they're not done. Right. And, you know, if you took a kill shot, you may be walking around having taken a kill shot, and it just hadn't worked yet.
Right.
Right?
The reason, you know, because but Sunak again mentioned, the reason they want CBDC and digital IDs is so they have the transaction control to force people to take the next round of injections.
Yeah. We're going to use a money system to kill who we want to kill. That's
right. Financial transaction control is a marketing plan for the genocide program. Right.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right.
Right.
That's how we're going to control things. And that's just my jaw hit the floor when I saw that graph. It's like there's three batches and placebo. Man. I mean, we'd covered some of those graphs like that before on showing the different batches that have different concentrations. But that graph, that's just...
Okay, let me just say one thing, John. So what we're talking about is running an experiment, okay? And prototyping and testing certain things, including clearly bad batches and placebos.
But a death experiment.
It's a death experiment and a sterility experiment. But at the same time, the whole healthcare effort as part of the Going Direct was a huge and fantastic financial and economic success, is what it looks like to me.
Sure was.
So the experiment is part of something that is making... that is very politically and economically successful for those who are trying to centralize control. And it's, you know, if you want to stop a policy, it's important to understand that it was successful.
Right.
Right.
Right. And meanwhile, in the U.S., life expectancy has dropped by, what, 2.5, 3 years? And no one's talking about that.
Like this, we keep talking about it every week.
This experiment is going on in real time. It's still going on.
Right.
And let me tell you something. These big companies, they're not running experiments for the benefit of knowledge and the advancement of science and all that. They're running experiments so they can figure out how they can do better in the future.
Right.
And how they can perfect it more and later.
Right.
And make it bigger and better. That's why they're doing an experiment.
And I don't think the goal is just depopulation or lowering life expectancy. I do think they're trying to prototype getting the equivalent of an operating system inside of our bodies. The Moderna chief scientist was totally clear about that. They're looking to install an operating system.
I don't need to go there. The death experiment, I'm good. You know, because if I believe that, anything else is just like extra credit gravy.
You're running
death experiments in real time? Death experiments. Okay.
Right. Wow. Well, that's why I want to sit down with Rachel and say, okay, you know, how much were you paid to kill this many people and sterilize this many people? And I want to know per death and per sterilization, how much you know, how much you got in kickbacks. I want to know
how many of your friends took the injection, and of those, how many took the placebo? right. Rachel? And how many took the kill shot? How many of your friends took the kill shot, Rachel?
Yeah, exactly.
And how did you make sure they didn't take it?
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway. Okay, let's go to pushback. Pushback this week is rich. It's coming from Europe, which is where it needs to be coming from. First one's from Sign of the Times. Norway bans child sex changes, joins Finland, Sweden, and UK in rejecter gender ideology. Under the proposed updated guidelines, the use of puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and transition-related surgery would be restricted to research contexts and no longer provided in clinical settings. Norway joins Finland, Sweden, and the United Kingdom in introducing greater safeguarding for children. In the U.S., 8 states thus far have banned affirmative care for individuals under 18, with Tennessee being the latest to pass such legislation. That's great news.
It's
spreading.
It is great news. It's great news.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a while before reasonable people realize that what's going on is this ridiculous and nuts and dangerous.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, the pushback's coming. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to the next pushback story out of Europe and the final pushback story of the week. This one is pushback. You got to wonder how much this relates to Ukraine, though. This is a publication called Slay. I'm not familiar with it. Sweden dumps climate agenda, scraps green energy targets. Sounds good. Look at this picture. So you have creep number one here, Bill Gates. Creep number two here, John Kerry. And creep number three here, Klaus Schwab. I didn't realize Klaus had such a weak chin. I'd never noticed that before. I'd never seen it. Anyway, back to the story. Sweden has just dealt a severe blow to the globalist climate agenda by scraping, which I believe means scrapping, its green energy targets. Instead, the Swedish government is shifting back to nuclear power and has ditched its targets for 100% renewable energy supply. That is great news. But you got to wonder, by going back to nuclear, how much Europe's saying, you know what? We fear freezing to death more than we fear Russia.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, it's what we talked about with the Zero Alliance coming apart. At some point, facts matter. At some point, real economics matter. You can't paper over this stuff anymore. So the reality of energy policy is hitting the grind of real money and real decisions. And at some point the operators come back and say, look, you know, camels can't fly. So
Yeah. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, Sergio, and he says, absolutely nothing in the media is real anymore. It's all, none of it's real.
Right.
It's a green energy is a perfect example of that.
Right. Right.
You know, right. So it's great to see reality beginning to dawn on the one place in the world, is probably the one continent that more than all others where it seems to have just been AWOL for a long time now.
So we've just arranged, we're going to be recording a big two-part series in August. It's called The 21st Century Approach to Energy. And it's an analysis. We found a wonderful expert. His name is Charlie Stevens. And it's an analysis of how the energy system combined with the political and economic systems really works, and how you would evolve a really successful energy policy if you were free to do so. You know, what would you really do if you were free to run things in a way that was sensible? And you know, it's a remarkable sort of breakthrough look at what to do about energy that you know, because I think most of climate change is a lie, but I think we have serious environmental problems and they need to be changed. And so the question is, how do we heal the environment and get a successful energy policy at the same time? And you can do it. You know what the number one problem is environmentally and getting a good... Yeah, it's the Charlie calls it the rackets. It's organized crime and warfare.
Yeah,
organized crime and warfare
is
running a model in which the energy waste, and the waste is unbelievable. It's off the charts.
Yeah.
You know, and it's back to comparing a Lockheed F-35 to cows.
Yeah.
You know?
And then your plane doesn't fly when it's all said and done.
Right.
It's like, wow.
When I tell you the human race and the planet cannot afford the rackets anymore. You know, the secret governance system has got to go. We have to bring transparency to the governance system, and we have to have a governance system that doesn't waste resources.
Yeah. It's like a race. We're running out of runway in real time with all these problems, right?
And then, right. And you got two forces. You got the rackets saying, let's get rid of the people. And you got the people saying, let's get rid of the rackets. And the question is, how are we going to resolve?
Win?
Right. There you go.
How's that one shake out? I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. Something to ponder.
Step number one is transparency, because the revolution was in the minds of the people, right?
The revolution was in the minds of the people.
Okay. So let's go on to some more brush fires.
All right. Let's go on to graphs, because we're done with brush fires. We're done with stories. Okay. Let's hit the graphs this week.
Yeah. So let's just take a look at the general market. So the S&P still, you know, who would have thought at the end of last year, everybody says the European market should do better this year. But no, the S&P is pulling ahead with all those magic smart grid builders. And you know, one of the things that'll come out when we talk about energy, the tech industry wastes enormous energy. So unfortunately, this S&P is bought with a lot of energy waste. So Europe behind, up about 8%. Is that 8%? I can't see it.
9.5.
And then, of course, China down, and China slowing down relative to its normal pace, and real housing bubble problems in China as well. So, and I think the fight between sort of the military faction versus the trade faction is, you know, it's causing China to slow as well. Anyway, so let's take a look at the new one. I wanted the next one.
The S&P is not the Europe and China isn't the only thing the S&P has beaten. Take a look at this.
So
S&P way up over those two.
Yeah. So I wanted to take a look at commercial real estate. So this is the one of the sort of big U.S. S&P. IYR is the real estate ETF, and CNBC is the commercial mortgage ETF. And they are holding up better than I expected.
Right.
Hovering
around zero, but they're holding up. They're not down.
Yeah. Particularly given, what's happened with interest rates.
Yeah.
And you wonder how come. Now, part of it is they, you know, investors want yield, and these things give you yield. So we'll see what happens. But those are two to track as we watch what's happening in the, as the commercial mortgage-backed securities roll over and people like BlackRock start selling off these portfolios. Okay, so let's look at the next one, because you and I were talking about, do you have the one with Schwab? Well, let's look at the U.S. dollar.
Look at Schwab. Here he goes.
So you were talking about Schwab being in trouble, and so I thought, let's take a look at Schwab, which is now trading with a regional bank ETF, KRE. And it's interesting because, you know, that's the one which is getting really slaughtered by the media, but you and I think, you know, those banks are in much better shape than they're saying.
I think this is a buy, and I think this is a sell.
Right. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
And although we don't make investment recommendations on the Salary Report, so do your own due diligence.
I gamble. I don't invest. So let me be clear about that. I gamble on ponies. Don't listen to me.
So the one above is the security brokerage ETF, and then the top one is really arguably the discount broker that offers the most sort of global sophisticated services, is Interactive Broker. So you can see they're almost up there with the S&P. Interactive Broker is tracking. The industry is not doing anywhere near as well, but Schwab is clearly in the doghouse. Now, Schwab is both a bank and a brokerage
and
service.
And brokerage, yeah.
Yeah,
but they're a big bank. They're in that top 30 list.
Right.
Big
time. And so they are struggling. There's no doubt about that. And so, anyway.
I may do a video on that. I may not. We'll see. Okay. Let's go to the last one here. And this will be the dollar chart. There you go. Year to date.
So if you read the news about all the different oil trades that are happening in Chinese yuan or the BRICS meeting, you would think the dollar was, you know, on its last legs. But it's important to look at the charts. You know, dollar holding relatively strong and up at 103, and it's on an uptrend. So we'll see.
Yeah.
This is one to watch. As you watch the summer meetings and all the discussion of the plan B, you know, important to watch the dollar. The dollar strength is everybody owes dollars, and that's why Argentina being allowed to use Chinese yuan to pay their dollar debt to the IMF, I thought was pretty interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. That is very interesting. Okay. Anything else on charts? That's the last chart we have.
That's the last chart. And now we just go to sort of the latest at Solari.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go.
Okay. Hero of the week. Because we promoted the Greer, Stephen
I know that
Greer.
Guy.
Greer had a webinar and then a press conference at the National Press Club with lots of whistleblowers on the essentially the secret space program. And, you know, he had some good stuff on invisible weaponry and Raytheon. Anyway, because of that, we wanted to highlight the incredible conferences that Robert Dupper and Jeroen van Straten, who are part of the Solari group, did. And that's how I first came to go to the Netherlands. If you go to this commentary, it links to all of those websites for both the Breakthrough Energy conferences and the Secret Space Program. And that is still, in my opinion, some of the best content ever done on those topics. And it was an incredible gathering of scholarship on these topics. And it inspired 5 years of disinformation. The wave of disinformation that hit after Robert and Jeroen did these conferences was quite remarkable. They were very special events. Anyway, so we just wanted to acknowledge those and make those all accessible to everyone.
That's cool. I know both of those guys, but I only see Robert. Jeroen, he emails and I correspond, but
yeah,
this is a face I see basically every week.
These are pretty talented people. We're very proud of them. Yeah.
Okay. Never Say Die with Naomi Wolf.
So it's interesting. I interviewed Naomi a couple of weeks ago. We published it yesterday for July 4th. It's a great interview where I walk through all my favorite Naomi Wolf sort of accomplishments, and we have a great talk about what's happening. I read her book, The Bodies of Other, which came out last year, but I just read it before the interview, and it is really good. It shows a lot of information about how the lockdown policies advantaged different real estate interests and slaughtered the... Oh, yeah. This is, you know, Naomi is both a tech entrepreneur and an entrepreneur, and she really saw the money game in the area where she lives in and around New York. And she did a very good job of describing sort of how they slaughtered small business and how advantaged different real estate interests. It's very well written. She's a good writer. She's a great writer and a really fun person to talk to. She's got a lot of juice. Anyway, so we decided to call it Never Say Die because her ability to just keep punching is unbelievable. She is not, you know, she started out as a progressive and the entire progressive world, except for her and Kennedy, sort of left the space.
And
they both just kept punching. And anyway, so we decided we would call it Never Say Die 2 weeks ago. And then about a week after I interviewed her, she had an emergency appendectomy turned into an infection, had quite an experience, and she's just home from the hospital. It was pretty scary because, you know, to go into a hospital if you're Naomi Wolf at this time is very, you know, it's very problematic. Anyway, she's got a great husband who was a real brick and helped tremendously in the situation, but she just wrote a Substack about her experience in the hospital, which is well worth reading. And we put a note at the top of the commentary asking that you just keep her in your prayers because she's a great warrior and a great, you know, she's a great intellectual.
And she is. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so it was a fun interview. I really enjoy her and we had a lot of fun. So I recommend that one.
Yeah. She helps. It looks good. You know, 61 years old, you know. Okay. Okay. Summer 2023.
A Solari member went on the road, did a road trip up to New England and back, and just had lots of comments about what's happening in the world, including the use of technology. It's an unbelievable story about young kids who can't add in their head. They're dependent on their phone. One young woman has said she used to get A's until she got her phone, and now her grades have fallen, and she can't add in her head anymore. It's pretty scary. So it's a reminder. Make sure, you know, do not give your kids a smartphone. Make sure they learn how to add in their head.
Or if you give them a smartphone, make sure they have a job as a cashier, because I was a cashier for a while at a restaurant, and you never forget adding and subtracting.
Well, the other thing is, it's great, you know, working with the public in that way. I worked in restaurants for years when I was in college and graduate school. I mean, you learn so much. For me, it was a phenomenal experience.
Yeah, you do learn a lot.
The last thing I wanted to talk about was login. So
yeah, what's going on?
We have a couple of issues with logins. One is, it's very important. If you come into Solari and you click on login and the pop-up box doesn't come up, you are probably using Brave. Because every time Brave does an update now, then suddenly the pop-up boxes on a whole series of websites, including Solari, will not work. There's nothing we can do. You know, what happens is it must be that Brave gets enough complaints, because then, you know, after a certain period of time after the update, it starts working again, and then they do another update and it stops working. Anyway, we're going to put a sign up next to the login saying, please, if the pop-up box doesn't come up, you know, please use Firefox or Safari. That seems to solve the problem in 99.9% of the cases. Okay. So please, when you log into Solari, if the pop-up box doesn't come up, switch to Firefox or Safari, and it should come up. The other thing is, a lot of times people put in the wrong password, and it's real easy. We've made it much easier to do a password reset. So there's a little note next to login. Here's how you do a password reset. When the pop-up box comes up, if it doesn't work, here's how you do a password reset. That, again, solves, you know, either switching to Firefox and Safari or doing a password reset seems to solve the problem. For security reasons, we do require a 12-character password, which, you know, creates more problems, but it also solves other security problems. Anyway.
Yeah.
And it'll show you on the pop-up, like, just do a support ticket. You know, if there's any problem, just do a support ticket. We love to help. But I think if you use Firefox and Safari, or you do a password reset if you're having any trouble with your password, that solves almost all the problems.
There's another browser you mentioned recently when I was complaining about one of them. Opera? That's all right.
Was it Opera? I don't remember.
I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, I'd love to. I'm always on the search for a new browser. So I have issues with all of them.
Here's the thing. What we're finding is, you know, constantly we are in a constant war. Another thing that caused a lot of login problems, we have a plugin that causes, if you log into Solari, then you automatically log into everything else. So yesterday I was working with you. You logged in, and I said, okay, just go to News and Trends Stories. Right. And it didn't automatically log you in so you could look at News, Trends, and Stories. It's very frustrating. And we had a plugin that did all of that automatic login, and they updated it, and sure enough, boom, stopped working. It's been 2 weeks of working with them. We thought we had all the bugs out, but we clearly don't. We're hoping to get the bugs out this week. But if you look at the shadow work, I mean, that one plugin update has cost us, I don't know, 50 hours between.
Yeah, I believe it, Catherine. I've juggled these things.
Right.
You know, I use Firefox as my go-to, but I use Brave for the show. And I use Safari when Firefox is misbehaving. And then I'm like, well, why am I pissed at Safari? I can't even remember. Well, anyway, I'm constantly messing with these things.
Here's what's so funny. It's the reason you want to walk back the digital systems in your life, we all use them. I'm not saying don't use them. The reason you want to walk back the digital systems and have balance with analog systems, digital systems were designed for central control. They were not designed for our productivity. And the shadow work associated with them is rising, and I think it's just going to keep on rising. So
yeah.
You know.
I think you're right. And in the end, I'm going to probably die with an encyclopedia open and an abacus, you know, lying on the pages.
And you know something? They'll both be totally reliable.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, I did want to mention we had another big lawsuit, Missouri versus Biden, and you and I are going to look at it for next week. Big decisions on free speech, and very encouraging, because if you look at this, the recent Supreme Court decisions on the Second Amendment or on the wedding planner or on affirmative action or these local judges saying, no, Pfizer, you don't get 75 years to keep your genocide secret. And
yeah.
Now Missouri versus Biden on free speech. Between the AGs pushing back and some of these judges, you know, life is beginning to perk up. So I don't know. I was very encouraged by what some of the judges have been doing.
It's encouraging to me to see our alleged intellectual class, at least some segment of it, beginning to wake up and show some sign of common sense again. It's been a while, guys. Welcome back. Thank you.
Yeah. Their family's got too many bad batches.
I don't know what it is. Anyway, I'll take it. I'll take these victories where we can get them, Catherine.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Salieri Report. John and I will talk to you next week.
See ya.
Have a great one, John. Bye.
Bye.